At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Fed is going to take away the punch bowl one day. You know that, right? But what do you suppose is going to happen when the taper comes? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 20th of November. Great to have you with us for the podcast today. This was, to be honest, a day of second-tier economic reports. Retail sales were up more than expected. Business inventories also up. Inflation not only lower than expected, but actually negative in point of fact. The consumer price index fell 0.1%, mostly on lower gas prices. But then, long about midday, the Federal Reserve spoke. We got a look at the minutes from the Fed's last meeting, and with it, a clue as to the fate of the Fed's program that's been buying $85 billion worth of bonds and mortgage-backed securities every single month for a whole lot of months now. The Fed says that while growth has been a bit weaker than it thought, it's still good enough for them to start trimming those purchases, thinking about it in coming months. And that much-awaited trimming has come to be called the taper. When it finally arrives, the stakes will be high. How do we know? Because Marketplace's David Gura has been talking to some expert taperers.
You want to know how to taper? Talk to Tom Camo.
I've been doing this for over 35 years.
Camo runs Michael Thomas Clothiers in downtown D.C.
This is our tailor shop back here. We have two or three sewing machines. We have all the thread. They have the press machine here.
While the Fed will be tapering what's known as quantitative easing, or QE3, Camo tapers pants. That's wide around the thigh, narrow at the ankle.
Your hand has to be very skilled.
If it isn't, if you cut off too much fabric, you could ruin the pants.
You can't make it too tight because then they can't bend their knee, and when they sit down at work, then it's grabbing and it's pulling, and so it's too tight.
If the Fed cuts too much, the economy could suffer. Camo knows when to stop because he's done this 1,000 times before. But you see, the Fed doesn't have much experience tapering.
It's definitely learning by doing.
Justin Wolfers is an economist at the University of Michigan.
And it's going to be a process of experimenting, and I think that's one of the reasons the taper is going to be so gradual.
Timing is very important when you're tapering a bond buying program. Kevin Jakes teaches economics at Baldwin Wallace University.
As the Fed undertakes this, it has to gauge how the economy is going to respond and how financial markets are going to respond.
If you try to accelerate the process, if you try to dip it too quickly, you're going to wash away all the wax that you've established.
Wax is not an economic term. Kathy Shaw is a candle maker. She runs the Beeswax Candle Company in Lynchburg, Virginia, where she hand dips tapered candles in a melting machine.
If you want to look inside, there's about 100 pounds of beeswax in there.
Now, I don't know what quantitative easing smells like, but this stuff smells amazing.
And it's about 160 degrees. If you have it too hot, it won't stick to the wick. And if it's too cool, it will get very lumpy. So we hope for the perfect temperature.
Kathy Shaw is worried about getting the temperature just right. For the Fed, it's about buying just the right amount of bonds. If it doesn't, according to Kevin Jakes,
the economy could slow down. Mortgage rates could go up. It could have an adverse impact on the stock market and financial wealth.
And consumption could go down, and that could be way worse for our two taperers than a broken candle or a botched pair of pants. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
A chart of the trading day will show you that Wall Street doesn't really want to hear any of that tapering talk. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Can't quite believe I'm going to say this, but there are only 34 shopping days until Christmas, gang. Feel free, by the way, to send me a nasty note if I do that again. But I did it today because the holiday shopping season price wars are upon us. Best Buy and Walmart said this week they're going to offer deep discounts on electronics. Amazon and other online retailers will surely offer their own deals as well. Great for those of us in the market for a new TV. Not so good for companies, though, when fighting like this breaks out, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison tells us.
Price wars don't just break out. Chains prepare for battle months ahead of time.
It may sound like it's reacting or that they're spontaneously deciding that they're going to run deeper discounts, but very often these companies already have that built into their plan.
Indiana University retailing professor Teresa Williams says chains stock their arsenal all year by setting aside money for sales, shipping deals, and special offers, enough to fund long engagements with the competition. But as a famous commander once said, no plan survives contact with the enemy. When conflicts get out of hand, profits at risk as companies slash prices more than planned.
Each dollar spent over in that markdown budget is a dollar subtracted from gross margin profit.
It's a balance struck by looking at company finances and competitors' moves. Retreat from sales and the competition captures your customers. Attack too hard with deep discounts and you lose money in a quagmire. Anything can be in the crossfire, but year after year, retailers push electronics to the front lines.
Some of these products, DVD players for $9.99, certain video games and so forth, those attract the right kind of people. So that's where the competition is.
NYU marketing professor Vishal Singh says shopper data show people pick up other things along with those video games, making up for the markdowns. Like any war, price combat takes a toll on companies. But there's a key difference from real war. Texas A&M retailing professor Cheryl Holland-Bridges points out that bystanders in price wars do well.
Oh, most definitely. It's a treasure hunt for a lot of customers. I'm one of them, too. I always like a good deal. I think everyone does.
Except investors, when retailers get too belligerent. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here's a piece of tech you're unlikely to see hyped much this holiday season, the landline phone. There's just nothing sexy about those things at all. And the copper wire infrastructure behind them is going away. It's going away slowly, to be sure. But this week, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission said he is going to start testing ways to replace the switches and wires of days gone by. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
Copper wire phone lines are
DEAD.
Or at least dying. Howard Anderson is a professor at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His prediction for their future is a grim one, unless you're a copper miner.
The finest copper mine in the world lies under our streets, and we're going to be pulling it up and selling it.
And he's not the only telecom fortune teller who's predicting doom. Scott Cleland is president of Precursor LLC and has watched the telecom industry for years.
It's really already dead model walking.
He says fewer than 30% of people in the U.S. still use landlines that run over copper wires, and the number is falling. Copper landlines and the regulations that go with them are expensive for phone companies. They want to get rid of them. Internet-based replacements are cheaper.
There won't be people that are capable to fix it, and there won't be the switches to replace if things go bad, that it's just going to die on its own.
His best guess for copper's last gasp is the end of the decade. Now he says we're just waiting on the FCC to write the death certificate and come up with rules for the new system. But what the FCC includes is going to help answer what, if anything, we might mourn in a post-copper landline world.
For 100 years, we've had a social compact with the network.
Harold Feld is a senior vice president of Public Knowledge, a consumer group in D.C.
We have required certain things like universal service and reliability.
If that social compact goes away, he says, there'll be a whole lot to miss about the telephone system of the past. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
In Mumbai, India this week, social policy came in the form of a bank branch opening. The The country's first state-owned bank for women is now in business, and it comes at a time when the very safety of women in India, much less their banking choices, is very much in the news. Yogita Lamai is a business correspondent for the BBC in Mumbai. Good to talk to you.
Good to speak to you, too.
This is it's an idea that makes sense on the face of it, I suppose, given the problems over there. The question that does come to mind, first of all, though, is how effective will it be? Can you reach the number of people in India, the number of women that need to be reached to make a difference?
Well, that is going to be the big challenge for this bank. It was launched yesterday, but the big task really for this bank is going to be reaching out to remote areas, to rural parts, because that's where it's difficult for women to have access to any formal financial system. Women often feel intimidated. You know, they don't, even if there is a bank in their locality, they're scared to walk into the branch and open a bank account. At the moment, women across India are saving money in ways that are not really secure. They're stashing them away in pots and vessels at home, and the big aim of this bank is to get as many women as possible to open a bank account.
Manmohan Singh, the Prime Minister, said that as he was giving his speech, actually opening up this branch, he said economic empowerment of women in India remains a distant goal. It seems a bit depressing in light of all the news and everything that comes out of India about women's rights and women as a part of society over there.
You know, he is right, because if you go to, you know, any rural part of India, you'd actually see women doing a lot of the work. So it's not just the housework that they do, but doing very hard work in farms, in fields. Often, they're the earning members of the family. But despite that, you know, they're not treated with the kind of respect that they need to be. And that's why, you know, one of the things that this bank has done is that they've trained all of their employees to be very sensitive towards the women who walk into their branch, to guide them with, you know, the little details of making a deposit, and therefore try and bring some sort of transformation in the status of women in India.
Yeah, imagine being an Indian woman of middle age, never having banked, and walking into a bank and trying to open an account. You wouldn't even know what to do, would you?
Exactly. And that's why, you know, one of the reasons why they've decided that they're going to have, you know, mainly female staff members is because they do feel that, you know, even from a security point of view, you know, it'll be better. It'll be more encouraging for a woman to walk into a, you know, into a branch which has all women there who are helpful, who might be able to help her out. So that's the thought behind it.
In Mumbai, Yogita Lamai, the BBC's correspondent there. Yogita, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up,
it's a mixture of remorse, regret, and also anticipation of a future, because the places are disappearing, but the farms are still being farmed.
The Great Plains in black and white. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, forget Dow 16,000. Now we're just trying to hang on to 15.9. The Dow Industrial is off 66 points today, 0.4%, closed at 15,900. The NASDAQ off 10 points, 0.25%, finished at 39.21. The S&P 500 down 6 points, that's 0.3%, ended the day at 17.81. You'd think good retail news would cheer the markets, but the Fed's indication that it could taper its stimulus efforts worried traders ahead of the holidays. The world's biggest retailer, Walmart, slipped 0.4% today. Amazon down 0.2%. Target dropped 0.2% today. There was one winner at the mall. JCPenney is discounting prices again, driving more sales and cutting financial losses. Penny stock up 8% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.8%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its producer price index for October. Dreaming of a white Christmas, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration issues its winter outlook. And it's World Hello Day. You can participate by greeting 10 people. So get on board. Konnichiwa. Hola. Bonjour. Aloha. Hello. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to pick up now with our collaboration with the New York Times. The new math of healthcare is what we're calling it this time around. Stories about the changes that are coming to that big chunk of all of our lives. Whatever happens with the rest of the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, good, bad, or ugly, or all three, in fact, a lot of people have already changed the way they think about healthcare, specifically how they measure what they're getting for their money. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary reports that is a complicated proposition.
It seems like it ought to be an easy question. When you think about your healthcare, how do you define value?
Easy access, good doctors.
They accept my plan. They're always really friendly, helpful.
Getting the care we need when we need it.
That was Cecilia Gollenbeck, Rick Diffendale, and Diami Plotke. Some New Yorkers I met who were getting health care for themselves or their families. You notice every one of them has a different definition of value. Diami Plotke works for a roofing company on Long Island. He's 35. His car has toys and soccer balls in the back.
I have three children. Three boys.
And one of them has Asperger's.
There was a time at school, the school aides at lunch found him over by himself laying down in the grass.
Teachers were worried that his son had fainted, so Plotke jumped in the car to pick up his son and take him to the general practitioner.
As I'm leaving work to go get my son, I called the GP's office, who was seeing my son at the time, and they wouldn't see me for 2 days.
And that was it. Before even pulling up at the school, he switched his kid's doctor.
It ended up not being anything, but that's the kind of issue where you need to be seen right away.
And what about when you're in the doctor's office?
I need somebody who I feel like is going to listen to me and spend time with me.
That's theater curator Emily Watts. She was uninsured for 6 years.
I think that that's something that people say a lot, but it means something different to different people.
Well, the way an academic defines value is not necessarily the same way that a consumer defines value.
That's Dr. Steve Wolf. He is an academic, a professor of family medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, and an expert on value.
The amount of dollars it costs for every life year saved or other health outcome. So that's a technical definition of value.
That might sound cold or clinical, but people who define value that way want to change the current system where doctors get paid by procedure regardless of how effective it is.
In the public policy world, where we're wringing our hands about the rising costs of health care and the fact that we spend more in our country on health care than other countries, we're focusing a lot on the fact that we pay for a lot of treatments that have no value.
Parts of the Affordable Care Act are aimed at changing this system. The law rewards better coordination among doctors and at hospitals. A lot of these seemingly upside-down incentives have created a business opportunity for medical practices that realize patients want extra time and attention from their doctors and are willing to pay for it.
Ron, how are you?
Hello, sir. How are you?
I went to a practice called One Medical. They take most insurance plans, but also charge a yearly fee, somewhere between $150 and $200, depending on where you live. Dr. Tom Lee, the founder, calls the fee a value proposition, a way to judge what he and his doctors are worth to their patients.
Our primary concern was that patients/consumers had been deconditioned from making choices on their own behalf out of their own pocket. And you could see the world's best cardiologist and the world's worst cardiologist for the same $40 copay.
In return for the yearly fee, patients can email their doctors, make same-day appointments, and spend extra time face-to-face. Doctors at One Medical have about half the patient load of a typical family care physician.
I was one of those bad patients that I never really went to the doctor very much, like growing up.
That's Amitha Raman. She's 27. She came to One Medical with a nosebleed last fall and has been a patient ever since. She was skeptical about the yearly fee until she weighed it against the benefits.
As a young professional, it was a cost that I thought was reasonable for the services that you were getting.
So, yes, she pays more for what she values, but that still doesn't mean the full price tag of her medical care. Because Amitha Raman, Diami Plotke, or anyone with insurance almost never sees the full cost of any procedure. This makes the question of value even more opaque. Health economists advocate more cost sharing, asking patients to have a little more skin in the game. But it's a hard shift to ask Americans to make.
I asked Diami Plotki if taking on more of the cost of healthcare would change the decisions he makes. He says experience taught him that it didn't work that way when his twin sons were born prematurely.
And if somebody told us to go to the specialist, we went for the specialist, and it cost us a ton of money out of pocket. But it was never a case of, well, can we do this that's cheaper? It was, this is what we have to do for the kids.
And that's why, in the numbers game of healthcare reform, it's so hard to calculate value. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
Our entire collaboration with the New York Times is in print today. It's also online at marketplace.org. If you go out to the Great Plains today, it's pretty easy to find the past, or better put, the past of a certain way of life. The family farm and farmhouses that used to be all over the place out there. Photographer Nancy Warner grew up visiting her grandparents' place in rural Nebraska, and in going back as an adult, she was struck by the disrepair, by the empty and broken-down houses where families had sold their land and left the farms behind. So she did what she does. She started taking pictures. And she teamed up with her cousin, David Stark, he's a sociologist, to interview some of the people who were holding on. Their book out of that project is called This Place, These People, Life and Shadow on the Great Plains. It's good to have you both on.
Hi, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
You know, the disconnect in this book for me is the disconnect between the sadness of the pictures of these old and abandoned structures that have been left behind, and then the words of the people, David, that you spoke to, and they are proud of what they had, and they're proud of what they did, and they're proud still of what they do.
And sometimes they're really funny too.
Oh yeah, well, so here's I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to start with this first quote. It's a woman who says, these old barns and such were built to last with lumber that was from older trees than what you find today. And pardon my language, but none of this 1x3 stuff. They didn't say that word. A 2x4 was a 2x4, as you can see if you go into some very old barns and measure the lumber. That's an awesome idea. A 2x4 was a 2x4.
It's a 2x4.
It's sort of not that way anymore.
That's right. And I think a lot of these structures were really built to last. I mean, it's taking years for some of them to fall down.
You know, it's these buildings are old, ramshackle, and they're clearly from 40, 50, 60, 80, 100 years ago. And yet some of the stories these old farmers tell are about, you know, using GPS and driving their tractors and stuff, Nancy. Right. I mean, it's kind of – there's definitely a disconnect.
Well, I think the changes in farm practices are what has really contributed to the abandonment of the houses. It's the farms are getting larger, so those are redundant houses, and it's hard to farm around them, so they take them down.
That's kind of a sad phrase, redundant houses.
I know. It is.
Yeah, when we talked with older people, a lot of the people's voices are older, but there's a young 26-year-old farmer. And one of the things that interested us was the way in which – what does it mean to be a family farm today? And these families face these interesting kind of contradictions. They prefer to grow food, but they can't afford to because they have these tractors and GPS instruments and big chemical sprayers that they're indebted to. And so they have to grow corn, which is made into ethanol or fed to cows or made into corn syrup. So there's an interesting way in which their knowledge of the land is changing, and what it means to be a family farmer is really something that's an open question.
Was there a story, David, that hit you the most, that hit you the hardest?
I think my favorite is this young farmer, James, and I'm on his tractor and we're tilling a field, and he's got a GPS on the tractor, and he's talking about planting. He says hopes are high. And he just talks about learning and knowing this field and, as he puts it, getting an understanding with it. And then you turn the page and he says, you know, but what I really like is chemical spraying. When I get on that big that chemical sprayer, I can really get it going. I got that GPS on the AB line and I can get up to 45 miles an hour. It just bounces across the field. I just love that.
And is this – are these pictures, Nancy, of a lifestyle and a kind of work that got left behind in this country?
I would say they're really more about, I mean, they are about a way of life, but they are interiors. So they tell a different kind of story of the life that the people who loved the buildings when they inhabited them, like the wallpapers, the curtains, the linoleum that they lovingly installed.
David, was there a sadness among these people when you showed them these pictures and asked them to tell your stories?
There's a sadness about something that's lost, and there's also a kind of stubborn persistence about maintaining a kind of life. So it's not only sad. It's a mixture of remorse, regret, and also anticipation of a future because these places are – well, the places are disappearing, but the farms are still being farmed.
It's a book called This Place, These People, Life and Shadow on the Great Plains. Pictures by Nancy Warner, the story and the text by David Stark. They are cousins. Thanks very much, you guys. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that Thanksgiving and the semi-official start of holiday shopping season is still more than a week away, a full week plus, people. So bearing that in mind, Dateline, Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, this item. There is a guy already camped out in front of the local Best Buy to make sure he is first in line for Black Friday sales. Actually, camped out is generous. His 10-man tent, he's going to be joined by friends later, but his 10-man tent has a generator and a space heater and a bed and a microwave oven and a laptop computer and a TV and a game console, and that's it. I just can't anymore, so I won't. In fact, that is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off 66 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 off 6 points. That is a 1/3%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.